Hi there, it's Old Brown here with another edition of the Outrate Capercast. I'm going to tell an old story this time, but first I've got some fresh news. The last few days I've had a great visit from Danny Mydlack. He's the media professional I've mentioned who stepped up to help us with our Outrate video trailer. I'm calling it a tractor. Danny drove down from Baltimore, where he's a professor of media at a large state school up there, Towson University. But his background is in avant-garde theater. And I get the feeling he's a very discerning and creative guy. He brought his cameras and a mini drone. So last Thursday, we took that up to the launching of Doug Jane's 53-foot constant camber catamaran that he's just finished building. It's number 8 for Doug. That's right, he's built 8 of these things, and between Doug and John Marples and I, we've got something over 30 of these constant camber charter catamarans now operating worldwide. They are fully Coast Guard certified for carrying passengers for hire, and as a matter of fact, the Coast Guard loves them. They have a very good reputation for durability. Now, Doug and his crew of 4 or 5 guys, a couple of them Mexicans that have really been loyal, he's already started on another boat. He started building this one on spec and sold it not long after he started. But his wife, Allison, is insisting that this next boat, they're going to keep it and operate it. They have a vast experience with operating charter boats in the Caribbean, particularly from St. John, U.S. Virgin Islands. But they've also operated from Newport, Rhode Island, and the North Shore of Long Island. So they know what they were doing, but what was it, do you suppose, that drove Doug into getting into this business in the first place? Well, the answer to that is sort of the punchline to this whole caper. I'll get to it in the end. But then last Friday, Danny and I went down to the Mariners Museum in Newport News, Virginia. I've been trying to get there for weeks, months, to see the new exhibit of the America's Cup 72-footer in their main exhibit hall. That's right, 72-foot long by, I think, 47-wide catamaran is hanging from the ceiling in this giant hall. It barely fits width-wise. You walk in that hall and it looks like a space machine's coming at you. And Danny and I were kindly guided through the whole exhibition by Mr. Lyles Forbes, who is the director of collections and the head curator for the whole shebang now. And Lyles came into Multihulls as a result of my receiving a phone call from one of the Piver daughters about 15 years ago saying that, their father had disappeared at sea years earlier, but it was now time to move Mom out of the family home, and they had 72 file boxes worth of Multihull history in the basement, and they couldn't find a place for it. Lyles said, "Gimme it." And that was the start of the Mariners Museum, by far the most extensive collection of both ancient and modern multi-hull watercraft in the world. So now let's put Danny together with Lyles and Doug, all of them illustrating what my punchline will be when I get to it near the end.
Yeah, sure, you betcha. I'll believe it when I hear it. See what I mean? He even knows when he's getting carried away, but he does it anyway.
Never mind now, Christy. It's not as bad as your interruptions. Shut up now or I'll close your program.
Okie dokie artichokey?
Okie dokie bitchy witchy. Let's see. Control Alt. There, that'll shut her up. So, we had quite a talk with Lyles Forbes down at the museum, and begins to look like we're one step closer to getting our Outrig collection there on the museum's website and accessible to all. Let's hope that happens. So the next illustration of this so-called punchline came to mind after we got home from the museum that night and I offered to fix Danny a drink. I said, "Hey, come on over. I'll fix you a drink out of John Dillinger's jigger." Now, I think some of you have heard this story before, but I put it to Danny. Here, this is a little chrome-plated brass shot glass that was one of a set of three in a little leather case. This is all that's left of it. My father picked it up in Dillinger's apartment that night they gunned him down in front of that Chicago theater. So I'm pouring this drink and Danny's looking at me saying like, hey, what? Yes, my dad was a G-man back in the 1930s. It was the real shoot-'em-up days where there was a lot of bank robbery and kidnapping going on. So as we were having our drink, I was telling Danny about my mom and dad, and it came down to being right up the ballpark for what he'd been pushing on me for the last couple of days, you know, to try to come to some conclusion about how this whole modern multi-hull thing happened. And it fell right in with why my mom and dad were there and how come I got here. So here's what I told Danny. It turns out that my mother was the only one of 10 siblings that ever left the high treeless plains, the Intermountain West. She was a high school girl, won the shorthand contest at the Cheyenne High School, and the prize was a job with the Wyoming State Senator on Capitol Hill in Washington, D.C. Okay, that's number one, huh? My dad was the only one of 8 siblings ever to leave northern New England. He came from a Vermont dairy farm. And in order to get away from milking cows, he joined the Air Cadets for a while, learned how to fly, then went out to Detroit to work on the automobile assembly lines. And it didn't take much of that for him to figure he'd better get himself an education. So he went to Washington, D.C., enrolled as a law student at George Washington University, and got himself a night job. I think he got the job through the university on the Capitol Police Force, which is a special arm of the D.C. police that just guards the federal facilities, the monuments, and so on. And he became assigned to guarding the Capitol Rotunda under the Big Dome. He received a little training in firearms. He'd been out to the range one day and come in to do his homework, sitting all alone in the Capitol Rotunda all night, nobody around. He did his homework, and then he figured he'd better clean his pistol, and he was messing around with it while it was empty, and then loaded it up, and because he'd been playing with it when it was empty, the damn thing went off. Now, I wasn't there to see this, but the way the story goes is that a bullet struck one of those bronze busts in the rotunda. I don't know, I can't remember, it was McKinley or somebody. Hit him in the ear, didn't do much damage, ricocheted off, and ran through one of the paintings on the wall behind. It was, I don't know, Quincy Adams or somebody. Hit him in the neck. Well, Dad thought sure as hell that somebody had come running, but nothing happened. It took him a while to get things cleaned up and patched up. He fixed up the ear and the painting with stuff including chewing gum. Now, I wouldn't blame you if you were figuring I made this up, but later on, as a 14-year-old or so, my dad took me to Washington. We visited the rotunda, and he showed me the evidence of that caper. And he got away with it. Well, he got into something else. One night he was sitting there, and he overheard a couple of senators talking down there in one of the nearby offices. You know, the senators used to have their offices right underneath the dome and those wings out to the side of the Capitol. I think many of them are over in the Senate office building now, but anyway, on this particular night, he overheard a couple of senators talking about how they were having a bad time of it with their federal police force. It was in the early days, and I can't remember what they called it, but it was the first arm of law enforcement that could chase crimes that crossed state lines. And, of course, the bank robbers and the kidnappers had run all over the place, and so they were having trouble, according to these senators, because the gangsters had better cars and better guns, and they knew how to use them. And the senator was saying, one of the first things we got to do is get somebody in here and teach our boys how to shoot. Well, my mother and father, Ralph D. Brown and Ruth L. Brown, had hooked up by now. And Ruth had even been up to Vermont with Ralph in order for her to see where he came from. And now it was his turn. Mom wanted to take Dad to Wyoming and show him the cattle ranch and the circumstances under which she had grown up out there on the prairie. And Dad was able to get some time off, but not enough to ride the train out there. He went down to Quantico, Virginia, and borrowed an airplane from the Air Cadets. He'd made friends down there. One of those old bi-wing trainers, a Jenny, you know. And the two of them flew that thing from Virginia to Wyoming. And I must say, I just love the image of my mother huddled in the back seat of that thing, all wrapped up in furs, you know, and Dad up there in the front seat in his leather helmet flying along, bzzz, you know, trying to follow the railroad tracks. And while I was there, of course, my grandfather wanted to show Dad all of the stuff that went on around there. And it happened that they had a ranch hand, an old sheep herder and trapper named Cooney. And Cooney was a firearms expert. He used to perform at Cheyenne Frontier Days, I think probably still maybe the biggest rodeo. And so they got Cooney out there, you know, he was shooting bottles in the air and doing all kinds of goofy stunts like shooting the cap off of a beer bottle without breaking it, stuff like that. Well, Dad, of course, was interested in learning how it was done, and so Cooney gave him some instructions. And Dad was impressed with what a natural teacher he was. Well, they flew back to Washington, went back to work. My dad had visions in his head of this 22,000-acre cattle ranch. I mean, he'd come from a little farm, you know. But it was right about then that he overheard this conversation of the senators. And so, talk about, you know, biting the bullet. He walked into their office and said, "Excuse me, gentlemen, I couldn't help overhearing your conversation. And I think I know somebody who could teach your boys how to shoot." Well, Mom wrote a long telegram to her father and said, "Hey, Dad, you got to get Cooney cleaned up. You know, make sure you get the lice out of his eyebrows. Get some clean clothes and new boots on him. Put him on a train for D.C. We got a job for him." Well, Cooney got off the train all right. And Mom and Dad met him and took him up there to these senators and introduced him. "How do you do, Mr. Cooney, blah, 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 you know. We'd like to have you go out to the firearms range with us and give us a demonstration." So they were walking out of the office. And then Cooney said, "We don't have to go nowhere. It's for me to give you a demonstration." He put his hand up around the back of his neck so his elbow stuck out in front of him. He put a silver dollar on the end of his elbow. I wasn't there for this one either, but I'm told. Anyway, he tossed the silver dollar in the air, managed to pull his six gun in time to blast it as it was falling toward the ground, and it went thwang down the Senate office. Oh, God. You know, people screaming. They got him out of there. I should say that Cooney used to make his own loads, you know, very low-power loads for these demonstrations, like so he could shoot clay pigeons and stuff in the stadiums without killing anybody. So Cooney went to work for the federal government, and the upshot of the whole deal was that my father got to know these senators, and just at about the time they were converting it, I think they called it the National Bureau of Investigation, when they changed it to the Federal Bureau of Investigation, my dad was just about out of law school, and they offered him a job. This was about 1930, I think, and by the time I was born in 33, my dad was the special agent in charge of the Chicago office, which is where most of the heavy stuff was going on. He worked on a lot of famous cases, and he used to love to tell stories about it. When I was, you know, 7, 8, 9 years old, we were living out there on Long Island, and he was working in New York, and Sunday afternoons, he used to fix a big bowl of popcorn and invite in the neighbor kids and tell FBI stories. Oh, man, do I ever wish I'd had that stuff recorded, because I can't remember most of it. But I do remember that pretty boy Floyd died in my father's arms after being shot up. Dad was trying to interrogate him for some information about the St. Valentine's Day massacre, and Floyd was dying. He had blood in his lungs, and he spit it in my father's face. Then there was that story about Babyface Nelson and another, the Barker Gang. And He eventually became a kidnap specialist, and he didn't work on the Lindbergh kidnapping much, but he did work on the Ross kidnapping, a couple of names I remember, Ross and the Bremer kidnapping in Chicago. And that whole yarn sort of leads into one of my previous podcasts. I'm sure I told you about my first boat model in the irrigation ditch at Red Buttes, Wyoming. I made the sail out of my aunt's high school diploma. It was made of parchment, you know. What number was that one, Joe? Gee, we ought to post the number for that one. And anyway, my folks went on to paint a nice bright stripe together for a while. But as I was telling Danny Midlack about all of this stuff, he came back with what he'd been hitting me with for a couple of days. Hey, Jim, at some point we've got to come to some kind of an explanation for why the modern multi-hull happened. Well, I don't know. It might have something to do with the times. In order to ever leave the Vermont farm or the Wyoming ranch, they had to put themselves out there. And Danny wanted me to tell this story here because he thinks it might have something to do with why I was, willing to build a little double outrigger canoe and take my pregnant wife to sea in the darn thing. And I got some of the same thing from Dad. I mean, when my brother and I were in our teens, he used to tell us, he'd say, okay, you guys, I want to give you guys as much freedom as you can handle it as early as you can handle it, but you got to handle it. Now, here's the car keys. Summer's coming. You guys got to earn the money, but you can take off and roam this country for a couple of months and come back whole. So we mowed lawns and washed cars by the hundreds and all of that, but took off across the country with a couple of friends, a couple of years or a couple of 3 years in a row we did that. Really got around, began to figure out how the world really works. We did a lot of hunting and fishing in the Rockies. It was great. I think I must have gotten my penchant for nonstop storytelling from my dad. Anyway, Danny Midlack feels we've got to get closer to it than this. That is, there's something more to it besides just the go-for-it attitude, the willingness to try, to put yourself out there. There's more to it than that, but that's got to be part of it, all right. Now, that spirit of adventure, of risk-taking, of exploration, was not unique to those times, that's for sure. But for Mom and Dad, the Depression certainly had to be part of their willingness to flee from the ranch and the farm. When it came our turn, me and Joanna, we were quite ready to flee from California. There was no depression. In fact, you could get a pretty good job doing anything in one day. But there was real social foment, upheaval at that time. You know, the Vietnam War was tearing the very heart out of the country. There were the riots and the peace marches, the killings at Kent State, and geez, the assassinations. And we were training our kids to hide under their desks at school to avoid nuclear incineration. And I'm just saying it again, that all had something to do with the advent of the modern multi-hull. It definitely happened within the context of the times. From just after World War II, right up to now. And of course, the go for it, can do it spirit has had a lot to do with developing the incredible technology that has come up around these boats. To look at those huge hydrofoils on the AC-72 and the rigid wing sails, all of that stuff is just outlandish. But I also think that can do gets close to must do now. I think on some subliminal level, there's an underlying suspicion that the time is coming soon when we are going to need this technology. It may be upon us right now, and I'm hoping that between me and Scott Brown and Danny Midlack and Joe Farinaccio and all of you who listen to us and help us out, I'm really hoping we can drag that need out of the subliminal level and really imagineer for what's coming for humankind and where multi-hulls might fit into that picture. But this is as far as we can go for now, okay? Fair winds for the holidays. Bye-bye.
Hey, wait. He forgot to tell you, again, that his article on the hybrid wing is now out. It's the current issue of Professional Bow Builder, available free in print or online. But he wants to show you the difference between what the magazine published and what he wrote originally. So, the full manuscript is posted on the Small Trimaran's blog. It's a, little, different. The editor had to cut out his poetry and blaspheme. If that's what you want to read, well, check it out. Bye.